This session we're going to cover basic Linux, how you could use a Linux system, how you basically navigate on a Linux system, and we'll be doing this. So since I'm, has anybody used Linux before? Okay, we have one person. That's good. Okay. Actually, I would imagine that every one of you have used Linux before. So let's see if I can think of a good example. It's slipping my mind.
Like Ubuntu?
Well, Ubuntu is one particular distribution, but lots and lots of embedded devices, like possibly your TV, if you have a smart TV, you know, if you have a printer that runs some kind of windowed system, lots of, you know, sort of non-traditional computer devices like your Garmin, your cell phone. Well, maybe not directly, but this is based on some open source stuff that came out of the Linux software project. And so, you know, probably all of you have used a system that runs on Linux, even if you don't recognize that it was Linux at the time. And if you're doing scientific computing or scientific data analysis, probably almost every program that you would run that's a serious program, like MATLAB, Mathematica, you know, all of these sort of data analysis programs that lots and lots of people use, generally have at least a version, if not exclusively, are written in Linux. And so this session, again, because none of you have Linux installed on your laptops, what we're going to do is we're going to practice using Linux on my lab's SSH server. Okay, and so you all have been given an account on that SSH server. It expires at the end of the month, so it's not like an indefinite account, but it should be enough for you guys to get practice. And if, you know, through some kind of collaboration, or if you're like really desperate for Linux, we might be able to work something out where you can use it longer. It's just that, you know, for a general class, I don't just open up my Linux server to people and give them carte blanche. The first session, or the first section of this module, we're going to sort of introduce Linux, talk about what it is, and then we're going to have a sort of a mini lab where you guys can install the SSH program on your PC, and I'll walk around and I'll try to hit the Mac people in one group. You know, the nice thing about the Mac people is that you already have an SSH client installed on your computer. Yeah, because you're all running recent Macs. And then we'll you know, play with Linux, and you guys can log in and see what it does. And hopefully you'll get a feel for why it might be useful. And so through that, we're essentially going to work through maybe the first three or four pages of this document, installing an SSH X-Window environment on a Windows PC. And then if you, you know, for later tonight, you know, I would recommend as a lab, you guys can work through the second part and sort of get the X-Window server installed in your systems. And so, essentially, why are we doing this? What possible use can this operating system have when Windows and Macintosh make such nice operating systems? To understand where Linux comes from, you sort of have to go back in the history of computing to where a lot of computational work was done on mainframe systems. Okay, and so this will be back after the time, you know, after you're beyond punch cards, so you're no longer using the PDP-11 punch card or the real basic computer systems that were the early workstations. And so now the era of of multi-user computing has begun, and so you're thinking about like some of the original hardware would be like IBM OS 360 type things, where lots of people are sharing a single computing environment. Computers in the early days weren't like what they are today. Processing time was very valuable, and so lots of companies that had these big mainframe servers they would bill you for the amount of time that you use. So if you were logged in for an hour and running a simulation or doing a calculation, you know, that's how you would be billed based on wall clock time. And nowadays, I mean, there's still some of that. So if you go over to the High Performance Computing Center, you know, they'll still bill you based on the amount of time that you use, but it's way cheaper. And they won't bill you for things like just setting up your experiment. So in that sense, it's a little bit different. But anyway, back in this time, the main operating system of choice, I mean, this was pretty much before, really even before Microsoft DOS was written. And so, you know, this was way before Windows. And it turns out the operating system of choice was this, Unix software. And it was, well, even before that, it was Vax, but we're not going to talk about that. Unix is the way to go. And you know, it was compatible with lots of people using the software simultaneously. It was written with a standardized type of programming interface so that you could access the hardware fairly easily without having to worry about, oh, am I on this version of the IBM system or am I on this version of the IBM system? So it was relatively versatile in that sense. And, you know, it was expensive enough that really big universities were the only people who got access to this. Big universities, big corporations. And so as academic computing research started, you know, people were just very comfortable using Linux. And even throughout the 80s and the 90s, as Macintosh developed, you know, OS 9 was sort of their first, what I would call, reasonable operating system. Windows NT was sort of Microsoft's first operating system that was worth anything, at least stability-wise. People had been using Linux for a long, long time, or Unix for a long, long time. And so back in the early 90s, somebody came along and they wanted to make sort of a teaching environment so that university students who were preparing for academic research could get exposure to this, and also understand a little bit better about how operating systems worked. And so that guy's name was Linus Torvalds. And so he basically took what he saw from Linux, or from Unix, and basically coded it up on his own, made a free version, and released it as an open source operating system. And then the Free Software Foundation, open source software became more and more popular, and that's sort of where we're at today. But because of this, there's still a lot of scientific holdover, and a lot of programs written for scientists are still implemented exclusively in Linux. And so that's one good reason why it's useful to know this thing. I mean, you could go through your scientific career and never have to use Linux once, and if that's the case, more power to you. But again, for my lab, some of the software processing that we use to analyze our NMR spectra, you pretty much can only find it in Linux. And so that's why I sort of had this and was teaching again to my students, and I figured it might be good to include here. Another reason that you might like to use Linux is, you know, for those of you who are used to Windows-type operating systems, so where it's exclusively a graphical interface, or primarily a graphical interface, you know, I'd say you're probably all addicted to your mice. And so imagine that, you know, you had to rename 1,000 files, okay? And so, you know, this is the era of big data. It's nothing for me to generate 1,000 files of data. You know, Yua, who's one of the students in my lab, he generates, I think, 100,000 different PDB files in the span of maybe a day, where he's just doing simulations. And so imagine that he had to rename every single one of those files, and he was using Microsoft Windows. So he'd have to click on the file, hit F2, right, type the name, hit enter, click on the next file. He'd be finished his PhD project before he even got finished. He wouldn't be finished his PhD project, but he'd be in the program for like 5 years. So Linux, in that sense, because it originated, and really all of these operating systems, except for maybe Mac, originated with a command line interface, has the advantage that you can do operations like rename thousands of files or manipulate lots of files in a very systematic way very easily. And so that makes it it's a big advantage if you can be comfortable with this type of operating system and do your data manipulations and then you're done. And so there's always a trade-off, right? I mean, if you have 10 files, maybe it's quicker to just go into Windows and rename them individually. But at some point, probably between 10 and 100, you're going to want an operating system where it's a little bit more straightforward to work on bulk file operations. Okay, and so that's another reason. The third reason I could think of is why people have sort of used Linux over the years is, again, partially historical. But again, you think you're Macintosh, you think you're Microsoft, and I said Windows NT was the first version of Windows that was worth anything. And that's because, Windows 95, Windows 98, they had Windows NT 3.5, so that was even good. But you could actually run Windows NT without it crashing every other day. And if you're a scientist and you're running a simulation that takes 3 days to complete, you don't want your operating system to crash on you, 3 a.m. the first night, and you're not around to fix it, or you don't even find out until the next morning when you get there. And so because Linux and Unix came out of this very rigorous sort of academic computing environment, it was implemented to be very stable from the get-go. And so my Linux system upstairs has probably been running now for the past 7 or 8 months without having been restarted. And so it's very, very robust. Actually, I take that back. I restarted the other day to do some updates. So you still have updates to do, but it's not like it's crashing, right? And so that's a big advantage. I've never seen a blue screen of death on Linux or any kind of analogous screen. So it's in that sense, it's really nice if you're doing long-term calculations. So that said, I think it's a good software package to know. Again, it's this module. We're not going to be able to teach you to become Linux experts, but hopefully you can get enough information that, if somebody says, oh yeah, here's a great software package, but it only runs on Linux in the future, maybe you'll know enough that, oh, okay, I can deal with that. If you can deal with that, if you can take the notes from this class and, a few choice Google searches on the internet and get to a point where you can get what you need to do, then I count this as being successful. And so the first thing that we're going to do, so you all have this sheet, and if you're a Windows or if you're a Mac user, you don't need to follow this sheet. I'll be around here in a little bit. But basically what I want you to do is go to this website on the first page and essentially download the SSH client. Okay, so this is it's a free software. Unfortunately, it's old, so this version is actually no longer supported. And so I would prefer to give you something that's supported and currently being developed. However, if you Google SSH Secure Shell 3.2.9, you will find that like 1,000 universities still maintain their own copy of this file. And so for me, that's a little bit of vindication that even though this file is no longer being maintained by the developer, it's still worthwhile to use. And so for you Windows folks, you can download that and get started on installing it. If you run into any challenges, I like to think this is written fairly well. Certainly raise your hand. We can ask questions. Well, I'm going to go around and I'm going to try to help the Mac people so they can get to the point where they can get a terminal window up themselves. Graphics on a remote server. So Think of it as the World Wide Web 20 years before the World Wide Web.
I mean,
it's actually a little bit more sophisticated. It's more and less than that, but. Okay, is everybody installed? Okay. So I will work with the Mac people sort of independently. But when you start up SSH, you should get a window something similar like this. Everybody have something like this? Anybody don't have something, doesn't have something like this? Yeah, you Mac people, we'll work on you. Chloe, let me know when yours is done installing. So once you start this up, as I said, none of you are running Linux on your own system. And so if you're going to practice using Linux at all, you need to connect to a computer that's running Linux. And so Linux, don't get the impression that Linux is only a command line based operating system. I can run Linux upstairs on my system and it looks very similar to Macintosh and Windows. It's just that because Linux is sort of originated as a command line interface, you can log in remotely, and it's very easy to send text back and forth between your computer and my computer upstairs. So what we're going to do is we're going to log in to my server upstairs. Hopefully it doesn't die, but we'll test it out. I guess with the exception of, I don't know your name, in the black striped shirt. What was your name again? Yeah.
Yue
Chao. Yue
Chao?
Okay. With the exception of Yue Chao, all of you have accounts on my system. I could add one for you later on. I just didn't know. Wasn't psychic. It's basically going to be your net ID. Now, for everybody except Becca, you probably should know your NetID. You have a NetID. I don't know it off the top of my head, but I'll look it up here. But anyway, what we're going to do is we're going to go up here And the first thing we're going to do is we're going to set some stuff up for later. Now, you're going to go in, and again, this is all outlined on your sheet. When you click profiles here, you're not going to see all these profiles. You know, I use this all the time, so there's all sorts of stuff set up. But we're going to go here into edit profiles. And again, I try to make the fonts as big as I can on the SSH window, but nothing I can do about this. And when you go here to quick connect, you're going to click the tunneling tab. And you want to make sure this little check mark is checked. Okay? Now, that reason will become why, or will become clear why here in a few minutes. Tonight, when you finish off your tutorial and you go through the rest of it and install your X server, Xming, you know, if this button isn't checked, it's not going to work. Okay, and so I told you that you could basically send graphics over the internet. So imagine that your system doesn't have Microsoft Word installed, but My Linux server does. You can go to My Linux server and type, you know, Word, and the window for Microsoft Word comes up on your computer, even though it might be running on my computer. Okay, and so that's what we're ultimately trying to do here. And in order for you to do that, you need to have this checkbox checked. Okay, so once that's checked, you can hit OK. If it asks you to save the profile, then hit Yes. And now we're going to click on Quick Connect. I changed my font size, so I don't want to save them. Yeah, we'll see if it keeps it. Okay, and you should get a window like this. And so again, this is accessing something over the internet. So I have to give you the name of my computer, the address. So think of this as like the web address or the URL that you would type into a browser window, except that my computer doesn't have a web page on it. And so what you're going to type here is block, and it's B-L-O-C-H, dot chem, dot msstate, dot edu. Okay, and so... I don't believe I've included that here because I don't want to advertise to the entire world that my server is on the internet. You know, you'd be surprised. About 2 days after I set this up 4 years ago, I had not told anybody about my server, and I was already getting hacking attempts from like Russia and the Baltic states. So to my knowledge, they've never actually broken into my computer, so I think I'm okay. But I do take security pretty seriously on my server, which is why all of your accounts will be disabled after 30 days, unless you make arrangements with me. Anyway, so that's the name of the server, and then your username again is going to be your NetID. Now, in my case, it's not my NetID. And raise your hand if you're working in my lab. So you guys, your username is Chloe. Yours is Cody. Yours is Matt. Yours is Rebecca. You want to know about that? I think actually yours might be Becca. No, I don't know that I gave you an official one yet. So we'll have to see. But you don't have a laptop anyway. Are you done?
Yes.
Okay. So, for you Mac people, what you're going to do... Okay, so that works. Let's try this. Okay. So what you're going to do, instead of starting up SSH Secure Shell, all of you were able to open a terminal. You're going to type in that top line, export display equals localhost colon 0.0. And before you type the second line, let me make a quick change. I believe it's dash Y. But we'll find out here in a second if it works. Okay. So type that first line, hit enter, And then type that second line, although you're, instead of using my net ID, you're going to use your net ID. And the computer is going to be block. So that's wrong. Okay, now don't hit enter yet. We're all going to do this at once so my computer has a shock, right? Okay, so once you have this stuff filled out, or on your Mac, if you have that, enter on the command line. So hit connect or press enter. Oh, that stinks. No, actually, it's not anything to do with you guys. It's because we're accessing it through the wireless network. Whoa, no. I would think that it should work without that.
I mean, we just need the password.
Yeah, ours. Yeah.
Ours just, we just need the password.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
That's it.
Okay. So if it's working, so who's it working for? That's pretty cool. Your password is your net ID, and then 0601. Okay, so you're going to have to bear with me. I'm still trying to figure out why it's not working on mine.
Did yours work?
Yeah.
Oh.
It's your
net. Yeah. But it's like
a one-way to. Oh, there it worked. Hold on. Okay. Who's having problems? Questions? Oh, well, your should be whatever the password you set is. Yeah, if you already set up an account, I didn't change your.
It won't like actually type the password. It doesn't show up.
Oh yeah, no, it's not going to show up. That's a security feature, right? If somebody's sitting looking over your shoulder, it's not going to display your password.
My password's not working.
What's your net ID? Okay, and you did
ACC28.
Well, yes, it'll give you 3 attempts.
Okay.
Maybe I did a typo for yours, so let me double check.
Okay.
Anybody else having issues?
Oh, this is the first
We'll keep working around. We'll be patient. People are starting to get, if it asks you, like, do you want to continue connecting? Like, this is the key. Just type in yes. You'll be asked that once. Then it won't ask you anymore.
Okay.
So I'm going to slowly work my way around. Yeah, but you need to log in as you. So when you put, so on a Mac, case is important. So it should be SSH dash or space dash capital Y, your net ID or your login information at block.chem.msa.edu.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah, right. And then they say,
whoops. Yeah.
That's what. Okay, let's start off. How do I?
Oh, just keep it under and we'll eventually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, you're already logged in,
yeah.
So you don't need that. And you only need to do that if you're on a Mac terminal. So if you've successfully used the Windows program to get to the server, you're golden. Just sit tight for now. Okay, I need to fix your password. You guys okay? Although you're using the Linkme terminal, so you want to click on the. Right now, that's the file transfer. So you're logged in. Are you logged in?
No.
Okay.
Do this guy first. Do you think we're good?
Yeah, but that's. Yeah, it says connected. Can you scroll down? It looks like you're. Yeah, there you go. What was your net ID again?
FMA41.
FMA41? Okay, yeah, I don't see you on here. So, so, FM as in Mary, A?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, I didn't see an account added for you. So, Fahad,
yeah.
You want to try it again and see if it works? What was your net ID again?
86289.
Okay, why don't you try it now? What? That worked?
Yes.
Okay, great. Okay, you should be able to go for it. Okay, so now we've got everybody sort of logged in. That was it's always a challenge. That's why I give this class an hour and a half, not less than that. And for those of you who didn't pick it up, if you're at home tonight and you want to send me an email, I should be able to get back to you at some point. Anyway, so now whether you're using a Mac or whether you're using a PC, you should be logged in, and you will see something like, you'll have a command prompt at the end that looks something like this. It'll be your net ID or your user ID at block, and then tilde squiggle, and then dollar sign. Okay? So now if you're there, that essentially means that you're in. Whatever you type here is being sent to my computer up on the third floor, and so you can run commands, you can, make files, edit files, do all sorts of things. Obviously, you guys have limited accounts, so you're not going to be able to go and delete my data or log out my grad students, or hopefully none of you will be able to crash the server. And if I type W and press enter, I can see all the people who are logged in. So now that's the other thing. If any of you guys do stuff that isn't so kosher, I keep logs, I'll know. And it registers everybody. And this sounds like, I have 30 people. Well, maybe not. Maybe 20 people log into my computer at the same time. You think, well, that's really impressive. Linux could do this back in the 80s. So it's not like this is taxing the operating system at all. Again, that's why, you could, well, I guess Linux could do it back in the 90s because it didn't exist back in the 80s. But anyway, this is not a challenge. And you shouldn't feel bad about doing this. It's not like you guys are messing up my system by logging in. One thing you sort of have to get used to is using a command line operating system. Instead of using the mouse to tell the computer what you want it to do, you're basically going to be giving it sort of keyboard commands to tell it what to do. And so I find that this is actually a great way to learn about how computers work, because at a fundamental level, the computer isn't saying, I guess in some ways they are saying this, you know, he's moving the mouse here, and he's clicking here, and then he's doing this. No, the computer is operating one command at a time. And the command line interface, because you have to type one command at a time, it sort of gives you a sort of glimpse into how the computer actually thinks. Okay, and so let's type our first Linux command. So I'm going to clear my screen again, so this won't be my first Linux command. But if you type ls and press enter, you're not going to see that because you're going to see your own files. So let me find somebody's files that are simple. I'll use Chloe. Okay. So if you type ls and type enter, you're probably going to see something like this. And this is a listing of files in your home directory. So as users on my lab system, you all have a home directory. Think of this as like your own personal My Documents, where your data can be stored. Okay, and so when you type ls, it stands for listing, and essentially these are the files in your home directory. This is the same, this is the Linux analog to double-clicking on My Documents and bringing up the window with a list of files. Okay? And so there's a couple of different types of files here. This examples.desktop, that's sort of like a simple or a system file. And if you were using the graphical interface, the graphical interface would read that file and do something special. But you're not using the graphical interface, so don't worry about it. There's a couple of text files. So I have test data and hello.txt. Those are text files. And then there's a couple of simple programs, one in Python and one in shell script. And those are green because they have the executable flag set, and don't worry about the executable flag yet. And they also have extensions. So if those of you who've used Windows and you don't have the super simple Windows turned on where they hide all the extensions from you, you know that a .exe or a .com file under Windows is an executable. So these types of things are sort of indicative of executables for Linux, .py and .sh. Okay, so does that command work with everybody? Now you Mac people, do you get color or do you just have black and white? Oh, sweet. Okay, so now I am going to make this a little bit bigger because I think it'll be useful. Okay, so now that we've looked at files and we know that we have some files in our directories, the next question that becomes obvious is, how do I transfer files back and forth? Right, if this file is sitting on my server, that means it's not sitting on your laptop. Okay, and so here's where things get tricky because some students get really confused. Is it, where is this file? Is it here? Is it there? Where am I editing it? And it can get worse if you're actually using the graphical interface and you're just bringing up a text edit window and it looks like every other Windows window and you're like, well, where is this file being saved? And so one of the things to think about is if you're editing files on the server, it's on the server. And if you want to copy locally on your laptop, you need to transfer it locally to your laptop. Okay, and now one of the reasons I really like, and this is where the Mac people are going to be left behind, there are programs for Mac that let you do this. You can write down, one of them is called CyberDuck. It actually runs on Windows 2. But it's built into this SSH Secure Shell client, so you don't have to worry about it if you have a PC. But anyway, so CyberDuck will let you, basically enter all the login credentials that you just did. You have to enter my server name, and then you can have a drag and drop interface to transfer files back and forth. On a PC, it's just a matter of clicking this little icon up here. It says New File Transfer Window. And if I do that, and then move the window over to the right screen, you see, now again, your directory is going to be much simpler, but you should see a listing of all the files in your home directory. And at this point, you know, you could either drag them left to right or right to left. I find it's much easier. So for example, if I want to transfer this file from the server to my desktop, to just drag it from there, and now it's transferred. And again, there it is. Similarly, if I want to transfer files from my desktop to the server upstairs, I could just drag this back. Now it's going to complain because it's going to ask me if I want to overwrite it. But, you know, it's a simple matter of transferring files back and forth. Okay? So it's fairly straightforward to do this. And again, you can see the listing of files. Now, again, mine's a lot bigger. And then down here at the bottom, you can see that there's a log of the files that you've transferred. Okay? So that's, you know, now that you've logged into my server, you know, if you want to transfer files back and forth, this is how you would do it. And so if there's a particular tool that's only available for Linux, what you got to do is find somebody with a Linux server, let them transfer your file there, run the tool, and then transfer it back. That's probably the easiest way to do it. Okay. So the next thing that I want you all to do is I want you to change your passwords. Okay, so this is our second Linux command. And basically it's very simple. It's passwd. And if you hit enter, and so again, right now, everybody in the class knows your password. If they know your NetID, they know your password. Yes. Okay. Well, I don't know. Maybe we can talk after class, because I type passes. What?
I cannot pass this day because they tell me default this thing. So I'm like, when you should default this.
Oh, well, you might just try logging in again. If you let it sit for too long, again, SSH is written so that it never drops the connection, but the university's routers and things, if you let a connection sit idle for too long, it'll eventually disconnect you. And so you might just have to try logging in. Okay, so if you type your password, it's going to ask you for your current password. Now, I know this is somewhat problematic, but hopefully you all can type your password this time. And when you put in your current password, I'm not going to change mine because mine's strong. But it's not going to display on the screen, so I can sit here and type, you know, as many characters as I want. It's not going to come up. It's not going to accept it as my password either. And then it'll ask you for your new password. So again, I would strongly suggest and request that you choose a strong password, not just your NetID, not 12345. Something that if somebody happens to stumble across my server while they're in the Soviet Union, it's not immediately obvious what your password would be. Now, in principle, yes, the Russian hackers will not be able to do much other than look at my files on my server. But the reason they're Russian hackers is because they know how to get around standard security. And so I prefer to keep them locked out the door if I can, rather than say, here, come in, but all these jewel boxes are locked. So please choose a reasonable password. Probably what you use for your NetID password or your Mississippi State University password is fine. It's not linked, so it can be different. Okay, so now we've changed our passwords, we've logged in. So now the question is, how do we do stuff in Linux? And so here is where this second sheet will come in handy. Okay, so this is a cheat sheet. That essentially lets you see many, many common Unix commands. Okay? And so since you don't have access to a Windows system here where you can click on things, if you click on this window, it doesn't do anything, except maybe copy and paste text. You have to, you know, if you're going to manipulate a file, if you're going to rename a file, you have to use the command line to do it. Okay, so now I'm not going to be able to go into Chloe's directory and change her stuff. Similarly, you know, just to prove a point, if you use a strong password, I'm not going to be able to see it. Okay, so here, let me show you what I see when you change your password. Okay, so it's not storing your password in clear text. This is a hash. Presumably it's a secure hash, but I'm not going to be able to hack it. So don't feel bad about putting a password in. I can't see what it is. Okay, so now, I'm not going to be able to change Chloe's files because I don't have permission to change Chloe's files. Now, I could change Chloe's files as the super user, absolutely. But as logged in as myself, I can't go in and start manipulating her files. If I try, let me go back and switch to a more reasonable window size. So RM, if you look on your cheat sheet, is a command for removing a file. So this is like dragging it to a recycle bin. Only there's no recycle bin in Linux. So if you delete something, be sure about it. Because it's not going to be there. You can't undelete. For the people in my lab, everything is backed up every night. So I do have a security measure against that. But for the boot camp accounts, it's just regular accounts. And even for the people in my lab, if they delete a file that hasn't been backed up, no luck for them. So if I go in and try to remove hello.txt, so again, see what I'm doing. I'm typing the command, rm, and then the argument, hello.txt. So this is telling it to remove the file hello.txt. And it says it's write protected, and it's saying, you sure you want to do this? And let's suppose I really do, because I'm just feeling really mean. And it's going to say permission denied. Okay, so I can't remove Chloe's files. Similarly, Griffin can't remove Chloe's files. Cody, as much as he would want to, can't remove Chloe's files. So if I'm going to demonstrate this, I have to go to my own directory. And so, there's a lot of crap on here that I can delete. Let's say I want to remove... Now, you guys shouldn't remove anything. But if I remove color legend... Now I have to put a slash in there. Okay, so I can remove colorlegend.r. And then it works just fine. Okay? Now, so let's play around with this a little bit more, though. And so I'm going to go back to Chloe's directory because I'm not going to do anything malicious. Let's suppose I wanted to look in one of these text files. So this is a text file. Now, that's convenient, right? It's not a graphics file. We're just using a text interface. So it would be hard if I wanted to look at a GF or a GIF file or a JPEG or something. But suppose I want to see what's in this file. So if I look here, and I go to my file commands, there's a command called more. And so I could type, and you guys can type this. So if I type more hello.txt, that shows me what's in that file. And so you guys should all have the same file there. It should say the exact same thing. And so, you know, if I want to access or I want to do something at the command line, I basically have to type the command and give the argument for what I want the command to operate on. Okay? Similarly, if you look here, there's another command that's very similar called less. And it gives you the same thing, except this time... It shows you that I have reached the end of the file. So less is actually, sometimes less is more. So less is actually a better file to or better program to run in certain occasions. Let's try it on a bigger file. So I'm going to go back and I'll look at update.pdb. So this is a file, this is a script I wrote several years ago to update a local copy of the PDB on my lab server. And so here I've run more. You can see if I press enter, it just takes me one line at a time. So this is a longer program. If I press space, it moves to the next page. So it detects the size of my screen. But if I try to press up or down, that doesn't work. And if I reach the end, it just returns me to the command line. On the other hand, I could type less and do the same thing. Although here with less, I can press up and down and it seems to work. Okay, so both of them do essentially the same thing. Less has a few more features than more. And that's probably why they were named that way. More was the first file because it pauses when there's more of the file to load. But less is just as good. Okay, so now you can look at files. And so if you go into your own directory, where you are already are, you can look at my program.py that I included there. And you can see it's just a very simple Python script. Okay, so there's nothing complicated about that one. It just prints a string. But now you can start looking in different files. So you can use more to look in different files and view text files. Okay? So now we've figured out how to read from files. But this is your home directory. And I tell all of my students, I want you to have, and you'll get to this a little bit when we do lab notebooks here tomorrow afternoon. But when you have lots and lots of data, like our typical NMR spectra is a couple hundred megs. And so you're not going to print that out and put it in your lab notebook. So you need to have some way of storing that online or storing that digitally. And so I tell all of my students, I want you to have a notebook directory in your home directory where you would store, notebook data, so your lab notebook, experimental results, and so forth. The advantage to having it stored on my Linux system versus having it stored on their laptop is that if their laptop gets stolen, it's still on my Linux system. If HandLab burns down, I still have a backup of my Linux system. I don't back up my students' laptop, out of practice, probably because I don't want to really see what's on those laptops. But I have all my Linux stuff backed up. And so I do make it a point that I want my students to put their data on the laptop or on the Linux system, because that way it has an incremental backup going back several years at this point. Okay, so let's pretend we were Chloe. We can't, because I can't make any directories. So let's pretend we're not Chloe. And I'm just going to go into a temporary directory. Okay. I'll make a fake Chloe directory. I have to spell it right. Okay, so now I'm in the fake Chloe directory. And let's suppose I want to make a notebook directory. So I want to make a subdirectory called notebook. So think about this as making a folder in Windows. And so the way that I would do that is I would type makedir, M-K-D-I-R. And again, this is also on your file commands cheat sheet. And if I want to call that directory notebook, I can call that notebook. I hit enter. And because this isn't Chloe's actual directory, if I do an ls to list the contents, you can see that it's now made a notebook directory. Okay, so this notebook directory can store its own files. A directory is a file in a directory, if you want the recursive definition. So now, I've made this directory, but there's nothing in it. And I have no real way to tell what's in it, except I do. So one way, and unfortunately, because it's so small, it's going to be kind of a no-brainer. But I can type ls notebook, and that's going to tell me what's in the notebook directory. So if I type ls/home/Chloe. That'll tell me what's in Chloe's directory. If I do ls/home/nfitsky, that's going to tell me what's in my directory. So same principle. I just type ls notebook. Oops. Ls notebook. So there's nothing in there. It's not interesting. Similarly, I can change my current directory. Okay. So think of this as, you know, when you have a Windows Explorer window open or a Mac Explorer window open, you're located in a particular directory. But if you double-click on one of the subdirectories, you change your current working directory. Okay, so we can do that in Linux, too. And so right now, again, if I look here, my current working directory is /tmp/Chloe. Okay, but if I go in and type cd for change directory and then notebook, you can see I've changed my current working directory into notebook. And now, if I type ls, you know, it doesn't find anything because there's nothing in there. Okay? In general, when you're in a Linux type operating system and you type, you know, ls or more or some Linux command and then a file, it's assuming that that file is in your current working directory unless you give it a longer path, okay? So here, if I type more hello.txt, it says there's no such file or directory because there's no file in that in this current working directory. On the other hand, if I type more /home/Chloe/hello.txt, it finds it. Okay? So this is a way that I can represent lots of different files if I give it the complete path. Similarly, if I type just ls, it assumes that I want to do the current working directory. If I type ls/temp/Chloe, it gives me the different directory that I want to do. And now here's one that's going to blow your mind, maybe. If I do ls dot dot, it's the parent directory. Okay, so again, this is a little hard to get around, get your mind around, if you've always worked in Windows directory systems. You know, Windows has the same thing, though. And if you go to some older versions of Windows, you might actually see that there's a dot and a dot dot directory listed in your current working directory. Okay? And in this case, dot dot means the directory up, and a single dot means the current directory. So let's go back to Chloe's real directory. Okay, so if I do ls, it gives me that. If I do ls dot, it's identical because it's telling me do a listing of the current directory. And if I do ls dot dot, it tells me the directory above. Now, for most of you guys when in the boot camp, you guys are in a special boot camp home directory. So when Chloe does ls dot dot, it's going to show this. If you guys are in the boot camp directory, you're going to see something like that. So you'll see something like that. And so you can see here, I used a combination of the two, right? So I can mix and match, and this would be a relative path because it's relative to my current working directory. Whereas if I have, you know, if I do ls slash, you know, this is what would be called the root directory. And this is the highest directory that you can go. Okay, there is no higher directory, so to speak. And if I do ls slash home, you know, if I start my directory listing or my file name with a forward slash, that's telling me that that's an absolute path. Whereas if it starts with a dot, or if it starts with a dot dot, it's a relative path. Okay? So half of the challenge of learning Linux is just wrapping your head around the different types of file commands and how they differ from Windows or the Mac operating system. Okay? But once you get the hang of it, so here if I go back to my home directory, again, and this is another nice nifty trick, if you type just CD, so suppose I'm in Chloe's directory, okay, and I want to go home. If I just type CD, it takes me back to my home directory. And so you can be lost in the file system somewhere, and you want to go back home, you just type CD, hit enter, and you're there. The other nifty trick, or the other useful trick, is if I type PWD, it tells me what my current working directory is. And so again, it's less difficult to get lost if you know where you are. It's not impossible, but it's less difficult. Have I blown your mind? Okay, that's good. See, now next time you actually have to use Linux, your mind will be less blown a little bit. Okay, so now we can go in and, again, I've already talked a little bit about how to delete files. So that's just the rm command. Yeah, Sydney. Okay. Well, we're almost done with this session.
Okay. It just keeps saying permission.
Did you use your new password?
Yeah. It says public key, comma, password.
Yeah.
So I tried the old one. It didn't work either.
Okay. We'll take a look at the break. To remove a file, again, it's just RM. Again, always be careful with what you remove. There are some wildcards. So if you want to remove lots of files, like I wouldn't do this, but if you go here, let's go to a directory that's useless. Okay, I think this is mass spec data. So if I want to remove every file, you know, I can type a star, and it will remove all the files. So don't do that in your home directory, because that would be bad. But you can see they're all gone. Now they're on my backup still, but they're all gone from the file system now. There's ways to rename files and directories. So for example, let's go back to my home. So for example, if I want to rename foo to bar, I can type the MV, which is move, and I move foo to bar. And now if I do an ls, you can see foo is no longer there. And instead, I have a directory called bar. Hopefully, yep, right up there. Okay, so this little cheat sheet, again, particularly for my students, this is useful. You should hang out with this. And then if you go on here, again, remember I said there's no way you can learn everything. But if you go, yeah, so this website on Surrey over in the UK, they have a little Unix tutorial that'll teach you a little bit more about the file systems and whatnot. I mean, I think the biggest obstacle to overcome when people are trying to learn Linux is that they simply don't have an account to access. They don't have the way to practice using Linux. It's not like entering these commands is hard. It's just if you don't ever have a chance to get exposed to it, or you don't know where to look for the software, you know, it's hard to get your foot in the door. And so hopefully at this point, you guys have gotten your foot in the door. Now let me show you some of the more advanced stuff. So you Mac guys, I think you can probably do this because you have X11 installed already. You PC people will be able to do this once you get Xming installed. But suppose I just type, if I type XEyes, oh, and it came up on my other screen, so it's not quite as dramatic. But here's my XEyes application. Now you can see this is basically the eyes are following my mouse around. Now there's a internet's kind of crappy, but you can see that basically the this program is running on my computer, but the graphics and the mouse interface is able to operate on my desktop. Okay, now that's great for, now can you, Mac guys, have you tried typing XEyes? Does it work? If you have X installed, like Chloe, I think you would be able to.
I typed it in part.
Okay, did you start X?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it just says that the connection
can be used. Okay, well maybe.
Yeah.
Okay, well maybe we'll have to try it later during the break. But, you know, now that's one thing to use a dinky little XEyes software to follow your mouse around. But, you know, let's show you some other examples. So, for example, MATLAB, rather sophisticated mathematics software package. It's probably going to take forever working on the over the wireless. I'll get my next. Now, you're probably not going to be able to go home, and if you just have, like, basic dial-up, you're not going to be able to do this via basic dial-up. But if you have a... if you have a reasonable fast network connection, you can run MATLAB on, you know, my... Well, don't, like, load 1,000 copies of MATLAB, please. But in principle, you could do this and operate MATLAB remotely. And so that's one example. The other example would be, now we can't do that. Let's see if I can get... I gotta remember my own password. There we go. So now let's make sure that I'm not. Yeah, I don't want to do that. Let's do this one because nobody ever uses the 300. Like I thought. So here I can log in to the 300 NMR downstairs, and we'll see if this works. Now, it's extremely slow because I'm using it over the wireless. If I were to work from my desktop where I have a wired internet connection, it actually is quite reasonable. But, you know, you can log in and you can, you know, I wouldn't recommend doing this entirely remotely, but for a demo like this, again, this software is running on the NMR downstairs. And so, but I can still access the windowed interface and get data that way. So it can be extremely useful. And, you know, Microsoft doesn't really offer, I mean, remote desktop is sort of like this, but there's really nothing quite equivalent on a Microsoft or a Mac system. But that said, Macs have access to X11. So it's so they have access to something like that, but yeah.
When you run the program like XEyes, you're not typing in a command or anything. So what's happening? Like, how can you just load it, even though you didn't tell it to do something? Like with everything
else,
we've had to hit more.
You are typing a command on the remote system, right?
Yep.
And so the way it works, and forgive me because this is getting to the outer crux of my computer knowledge. But as far as I can tell, the way this works is when you click tunnel X11 connections. The SSH server on my system is opening what's called a port, or actually really a socket. So it's a way for the programs on my system to send data directly back and forth to the data on to the programs on your computer.
Is there any way to like list what programs there are, or do you just have to know that they're there? Not that I want to like get up in your computer, but just in general.
It's easiest if you know that they're there. We didn't go over tab completion. Let me close this. Hopefully. Yeah, I think I might have bit off more than I can chew. But I think if you hit tab twice,
Says there four.
Yeah.
4,030 possibilities.
So, what this is doing is, you know, and we didn't really talk about this, but. And this can be extremely useful. If I type XEY, I'm lazy because all chemists are lazy, and I hit tab, it automatically completes it. So it recognizes that there's only one unique completion for that system to that command to run. Similarly, if there's a really long file name, like suppose I want to delete this debug log, you know, I can type RMC:. Yeah, I guess I have to type just the capital. Okay, yeah. So it's a little bit tricky because I have to escape these special characters. So let's find something that's a little easier. So suppose I want to delete this T1001 file. So I can just type T1, hit tab, and it completes it for me. And so that's a feature of the shell. That's not really the operating system, but that distinction is probably not a big deal at this point. That is the list of the programs, but essentially what XSize does is XSize is written as an X11 program. It says, you know, when it runs, it says, I don't know who I'm communicating with. Maybe I'm sitting upstairs on my computer running XSize, or maybe I'm sitting down here. But it knows that it's going to access the appropriate Unix socket, so that's some address in the operating system, and it's just going to send its graphical data to. On this end, on my laptop, SSH is receiving that graphical data, and when we, you know, was it working for you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I downloaded
them. Oh, you downloaded Xming already? Okay, so Xming is sitting on your computer waiting for data to be received. And so the SSH program is basically sending Xming the graphical data from my computer upstairs. Okay, so technically speaking, you're right. We didn't run anything on your computer, but Xming was already running, and when my computer sent the request to your computer, it opened up the window. So that's where it comes from. And by doing this over SSH, so SSH is encrypted, it's as secure as you can be as a consumer in the US. That's not to say NSA can't look at it, and even with the Patriot Act not passing, I'm sure NSA is going to be able to look at this day in, day out. But Joe Blow on the street, or a random Russian hacker guy, is not able to easily decrypt the stream. And so that's good, right? Because, you know, imagine, you could imagine all sorts of ways to take advantage of this maliciously, right? You type a command on my server, and it brings up something that looks like a website asking you to log into your bank account. You know, there's all sorts of ways that this could be exploited, and you don't want to. You certainly wouldn't want to open your computer up so that X11 server or Xming would just accept connections from anybody and show graphics to your display. That would be bad. And so SSH, I mean, it's limited to my server. And in general, I think it's a good idea, although I don't really follow it because I'm lazy again. In general, I think it's a good idea not to have Xmin running all the time. So you're certain the tutorial that you guys have for PC has it in the startup directory, and it basically runs on login. I've never had any problems with it, but if you're a real security freak and you're nervous about Big Brother, it probably makes sense if you don't want to have that start up. Just run Xmin when you plan to log into a Linux server and use X11. Okay, so, but that's roughly how it works. Other questions? I mean, this is probably the first time a lot of you guys have seen anything like this, so I understand it's going to be way different. But give it practice. If you're not using it for your research, there's no reason to practice it. But this way, at least, if it comes up in the future, you've seen it before, and you can handle it. You're good. Okay. Well, I think it's our break time now. So let's come back, because I think we stopped at 3 now. Is that true?
It
says. Okay. Take a 10-minute break. Come back, and we'll talk in 10 minutes, and then that'll be the last session.